is rather to be understood as a complex network of different cultural practices than an entity of its own. Christopher Small, therefore, has coined the term musicking to make clear that music is not a thing at all, but an activity. Activities, however, may not only be understood as more or less unbiased actions, but as practices that are both based on and establish certain meanings. Small's definition, quote, to music is to take part in any capacity in a musical performance, whether by performing, by listening, by rehearsing or practicing, by providing material for performance, what is called composing, or by dancing, end quote. As incomplete as it is, makes clear that to music is related to a complex network of interdependent communication practices. But since it is difficult to think of communication without thinking of meaning, I suggest to refer to musicking as a set of cultural practices that aim to communicate meaning. It is as courageous as risky to give a general definition of musicking that is suitable to any musical performance, particularly since the term musical performance is based on the notion that a performance is attributed by something that is only just defined. But beyond sophistries of this kind, one has to admit that musicking also incorporates activities that are responsible for the activities being meaningful, activities that are subject to potentially discursive processes. The attempt to investigate these processes in general was as presumptuous as futile, but it seems promising to do so in a definite case study. This attempt shall be made here on the basis of a musical performance that took place at the 20th Early Music Festival Hapsalu on 4th of July 2013, when the viol ensemble Phantasm played a concert with the heading Perilous Polyphony in the Hapsalu Dome Church. The small town Hapsalu, located at the western coast of Estonia, was famous since the early 19th century for its spa facilities. It was popular with holidaymakers mainly from the Baltic region and from Petersburg, who relied on the curative properties of the local mud that the doctor Carl Abraham Hunius had discovered and described in his medical dissertation thesis submitted at the University of Tartu. Like other spas of the Baltic region, Hapsalu attracted a more or less solvent public. Spa facilities like the Kursaal reflected the sophisticated status. With its first archival record given in 1279, however, Hapsalu has already been important as episcopal see in the late Middle Ages and early modern times until the see was moved to Kuressaare on the nearby island Saaremaa in 1562 as a result of the breakdown of the Livonian Confederation and the struggle about supremacy in the Baltic region between Denmark, Sweden, and Russia. The Hapsalu Dome Church, like other parts of the German order-influenced Baltic region, surrounded by a bishop's castle, is related to this former significance. Meanwhile, the Lutheran Church of Estonia, where Hapsalu is the see of the provost of the church district Hapsalu, uses this dome church. This information is necessary framework for my following reflections that have their starting point at the second concert of the 20th Hapsalu Early Music Festival on 4th of July 2013. This concert was performed by the viol concert Phantasm with Mikko Perkola, Marku Lola Jan Mikola, and Lawrence Dreyfus, who is the artistic director of the ensemble, and it was captioned as Perilous Polyphony. In the festival brochure, Dreyfus explains, quote, the idea behind this program, rather than listen to the many voices of polyphonic music merely for the beautiful sonorous effect they make, it is exciting and worthwhile to focus on the perils of writing polyphony that takes very seriously both the integrity of each part, as well as the striking ways in which each can be combined and counterposed with others. All the composers whose works we are representing this evening take some fascinating contrapuntal risks in their composition. Risks understood not only in the technical sense of audacious harmonies, peculiar melodies, and unsettling rhythms, but also in the more global sense of endangering conventional ideas of musical character and styles, even sometimes threatening musical coherence itself." End quote. This text is in a remarkable way focused on the listeners, who are advised to listen to the contrapuntal structure of the pieces, to the details of the parts, and their respective interdependencies, rather, than to the sounding whole, in order to discover the perils of the compositions, perils that have the potential to even affect musical coherence itself. Perils of this kind appeared, for example, in the second piece of the program, Elway Bevan's Browning, a piece that is quite popular among viol players, though neither the piece itself nor the composer are of major interest to both performers and scholars beyond this repertoire. Nearly nothing is known of Bevan's life, besides him being organist at the Bristol Cathedral from 1589 to 1637 or 38. In 1631, he published a brief and short instruction to the art of music. However, of his compositions, only some 10 pieces are preserved in manuscripts belonging to several Great Britain libraries. His Browning is only one of 4 instrumental pieces. Browning is closely related to William Byrd's 5-part viol piece of the same title. Though both compositions are undated, it is quite likely that the older Byrd was the first one to compose the Browning. However, due to the lack of further information, there cannot be any evidence. But the scores of both pieces show clearly that they refer to each other in a very dense way. They are based on the first 2 lines of a folk song that serves as musical material for the composition. Byrd contrasts these lines with 2 other soggetti in the first bars. The composition then consists more or less merely of the contrapuntal play with these 3 soggetti that are combined with each other in a wide variety of ways, including transpositions. In the course of the composition, the soggetti recede more and more, and some new musical material is introduced that brings up different contrapuntal and rhythmical challenges, for example, a section with triplet meters where Byrd sets regular 8 and triplet 8s against each other at the beginning and the end of this section. Bevan, in turn, bases his entire composition upon the given 2 lines from the song, which alternate consistently in the 3 parts, beginning and ending with the tenor voice and followed by the treble voice and the bass with regularity. Only 1 exception can be observed. In bar 44, the treble voice reads FE, where according to the song, it ought to read FDE. However, this would have caused parallel 5th with the bass line. It was quite easy to fill numerous pages with detailed analysis of the contrapuntal refinements in both pieces. Dreyfus's program notes, however, suggest analyzing rather the listening perception and thus the discursive attribution of meaning to Bevan's Browning as it happened by the headline, happened by heading the Hapsalu concert Perilous Polyphony, as well as by simply naming the perils of writing polyphony in Dreyfus's program notes. To understand these perils that are thought to be capable of even threatening musical coherence itself, it is necessary to fine to define musical coherence as Bevan may have understood it. As a heuristic approach, I suggest to base this definition on Bevan's brief and short introduction. Even if this instruction is mainly about writing canons of all kind, it has the advantage to deal with compositions upon the plain song, a possible reference to his Browning. Moreover, the instruction allows to at least slightly investigate Bevan's understanding of music being based on contrapuntal rules. Rules, however, that are hardly explained, but exemplified in a number of canons that proceed from simple two-part note-against-note settings to complex five-part canons, and finally puzzle canons and polymorphic canons of up to 63 voices. Only at the beginning of his instruction, Bevan lists the concords, unison, third, fifth, and sixth, and the discords, second, fourth, and seventh, and explains that the discords, which being sometimes mixed with concords, make best music, being orderly taken. What he means with orderly has to be deduced from his canons in detail, however. Two examples from Bevan's Browning may illustrate where the musical coherence is potentially threatened. The first one has already been quoted, the altering of the song line in bar 44 to avoid parallel fifth. Indeed, though Bevan never refers to this rule in his instruction, Bevan rigorously omits writing parallels of perfect concords in his canons. However, he also never alters the plain song melody, which consists of only seven notes in his examples. It seems as if the octave line in the bass part is contrapuntally superior to the treble part and forces it to alter the song line, thus threatening the inviolability of the given material. This is what we had. So, the second example comes from the clausula in bar 26 to 27. Even inexperienced listeners will notice the opposition of C sharp in the treble part against C natural in the tenor part. Both notes are justified. C sharp is the necessary leading note in the upper voice, building the penultima together with the E in the bass part and leading to the perfect concord D in both voices. In the tenor voice, the C natural is preceded and followed by a B flat, so that C natural has to be written in order to avoid an augmented second in the line. Again, Bevan does not refer to this rule in his instruction, but rigorously omits writing augmented intervals of any kind in the canons. Even if there are no examples of simultaneous oppositions of leading notes with natural tones, however, false relations occur occasionally in the penultima of some canons, making clear that, to Bevan, the linear coherence of each voice is superior to the tonal coherence of the polyphonic whole. As harsh as the clausula may unexpectedly sound, in Bevan's understanding, I assume, musical coherence is not affected here, above all, not endangered. Besides their respective evaluation, both examples can only be perceived in their perilousness by learned listeners or connoisseurs that are familiar with the rules of counterpoint and the compositional strategies that Bevan pursued in his piece. Since the Haapsalu Early Music Festival is devoted to early music to be played on period instruments, one could call them historically informed listeners. And yet it is questionable whether historically informed listening restitutes a contemporary audience to the condition of listeners in Elizabethan Britain. Since postmodern conditions of listening to music are entirely different to pre-modern consciousness. As far as listening is regarded as a cultural practice, it is unavoidable to admit that a contemporary audience encounters Bevan's Browning on entirely different understanding, which can only rudimentarily deduced from secondary sources like drawings or writings that for themselves are subject to discursive processes. Shai Burstyn stresses this by relating the notion of the period ear, a term inspired by Michael Baxandall's discussion of the period eye, to a general perspective framed by Bruno Nettel. Quote, "The way in which musicians think musically, the ways in which they, as it were, think their music, depends in large measure on ways in which they think of their world at large." End quote. Even if this perspective raises issues, it makes clear that thinking music is not based on persistent notions, but on relative consciousness. And Nettel is to be followed in this respect. It should not get out of focus that thinking of the world at large is tantamount to thinking of meanings caused by discursive processes, meanings that are by no means irrevocable. Burstyn tries to adopt Nettel's perspective by opening the historical, social, intellectual, and cultural contexts of listening to music. In doing so, he comes to the conclusion, quote, "Considering the objective obstacles standing in the way of scholars attempting to reconstruct the period ear of past listeners, the undertaking is nothing if not audacious. It is circumscribed by the same constraints that delimit and to an extent hinder any historical investigation which seeks to reach beyond the external evidence of the deeds of past humans to the mental structures which caused them to comprehend, feel, and create in the ways they have." End quote. The historical dilemma that Burstyn points out here does not only apply to a discipline that Christopher Pages names listening practice, but also and mainly to the hereby referenced performance practice as one of the key concepts of the early music movement. The often stressed quest of authenticity in the performance of early music incorporates the choice of period instruments, as well as any parameters of musical interpretation, such as tempo, phrasing, articulation, ornamentation, and so on, where often historical treatises serve as taken for granted reference to modern performers. Even if a historically informed interpretation of these treatises can be successful, however, there are more questions remaining. These affect questions of historical evidence, such as where the music has been played and how the acoustics of a certain space influence the parameters of musical interpretation. On the other hand, these affect questions that reach beyond historical evidence, such as how the perception of the music has been related to past listeners' consciousness. In a way, the experience of modernity is blocking the approach to the period ear, as it can be seen in the given analysis of the two examples of Bevan's Browning. They are based on a concept of structural listening that is thought to derive from the concept of a musical modernity originating with Arnold Schoenberg and Theodor Adorno, a concept that neglects the different modes of bodily experience and cultural identity, let alone the question whether a piece for viol concert is intended to be listened to by an audience beyond the players themselves at all. Annette Otterstedt states that, like the later string quartet, the viol concert is in first instance a private enjoyment, which she emphasizes with a poem by Ned Ward, written around 1700. "Lead away, Mr. Prim. Sir, do you follow him? How the part, party sweetly chime. Mr. Clot, mind your time. 'Tis a wonderful tune, though it's plain what a cadence is there, how it tickles the ear. You're too fast, sir, forbear. We are all out, I swear. Since 'tis good, let's begin it again. Imagining this vile consort playing Bevan's Browning is quite easy, not only because of the reference to the ear-tickling cadence that reminds of the Clausula in bar 26 to 27. But in doing so, it also gets clear that playing, listening, and exchanging views about the music are inextricably interwoven. At first glance, a contemporary concert situation like the one described at the Hapsalu Early Music Festival is entirely different. The musicians are playing in the presbytery of the Dome Church, while the audience is sitting and listening in the nave. Etiquette rules apply that include that neither the musicians nor the audience is allowed to talk during the concert. If there is communication going on, it is nonverbal communication. The concert situation, however, is embedded in a dense network of discursive relations that all play a role for the notional communication during the concert. Dreyfus's program notes play an important role here, since they evoke the notion of perilous polyphony. The space where the concert takes place, however, is perhaps even more important in this respect. The Dome Church is a sanctuary, and whether the listeners are sympathetic to Christian faith or not, they have to accept that Provost Tiit Salume opens each concert in the Dome Church, despite of its program, with a short devotion and a prayer. In doing so, he declares a concert with perilous polyphony as sort of a divine act. This is part of framing both the concert itself and the Hapsalu Early Music Festival as a whole, where two of the main venues are churches and thus provide a sacred space for the concerts that is seamlessly fitting to a performance of Johann Sebastian Bach's Mass in B minor, the concluding concert of the 20th Hapsalu Early Music Festival, but not to a concert with perilous polyphony. The festival as a whole, thus, is surrounded by or embedded in a sacrosphere, a sphere of uncertain range that is discursively constructed by framing, musicking with the religious. As far as I can see, the term sacrosphere has been coined by the Polish art historians Korolczuk and Szewczyk to describe the specific existence of endemic religious artifacts in the ancient region of the Bialystok uplands in the northeast of Poland. But the basic concept can also be adopted for the Hapsalu Early Music Festival. In this sense, a sacrosphere comprises everything that is made religiously meaningful. A sacrosphere is immersive and therefore affects and alters all kinds of sensual perception. And therefore, finally, the quest of historically informed listening, as it turns out to potentially be perilous if listening to perilous polyphony is vain endeavor. In the end, however, this should turn out to be a benefit, since listening to music thus is embedded in a more holistic concept of sensual perception, like the notion of musicking is a more holistic concept of what we like to call music. Thus, it is also a low threshold service, since it is less exclusive compared to the concept of an audience being historically informed. Thank you very much.